Welcome to This Is Money in partnership with NS&I. I'm your host, Georgie Frost, and alongside editor Simon Lambert and I today is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And coming up, would you challenge a will? More of us are doing it, but is it worth the trouble? Should Simon have sold his Lloyd shares long before now, or are the lessons learnt even more valuable? What happens to your ISA if you move down under? And how one little prang could lead to a bombardment of nuisance calls. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. Now you can start saving from just £25. Millions of tax-free prizes every month.
Now, as if the death of a loved one isn't tough enough, having to then deal with the will or the admin that comes with that can just, of course, add another layer of stress onto what is an already really upsetting time. And that's if everything runs as it should do. But what if you read the will and you don't agree with it? Would you contest? A new survey suggests a quarter of us would mount a legal challenge against a loved one's will if we were unhappy with it. And the figures show we are actually doing that. It is on the rise. So, Lee, Simon, welcome. Firstly, Lee, would you ever do it?
Well, you think to yourself, you like to think that if a will was written, that will was written for a reason and you want to respect the wishes of whoever's written that will. It's just personal circumstances, isn't it? So it's very difficult for me to sit here and go, I definitely wouldn't contest the will. But things happen. Really common example is that your parents might marry someone else and you might not be happy with the slice of the will share that goes to the partner because perhaps you don't get on with them or perhaps you feel like it's unfair. But my hunch is that I would just respect the wishes of any of my relatives that had written the will. But it's those classic getting influenced or shaped decisions. And that's what we read about quite a lot in the media, isn't it? Those kind of, were they forced on their deathbed type thing to change their will?
Yeah. And that's a really good point. And it is down to, I suppose, who the person is who's died, the circumstances surrounding how that will was made, what's in that will. I'd like to hope that even if I wasn't happy, I could be the bigger, better person. Because to my mind, the stress and the emotional stress, can I put a price on that?
Yeah, exactly, Georgie. I agree. And also the other classic example is when a relative, we'll stick with the relative theme, makes a massive donation to charity, for example. Like a large portion goes to charity and then the kids or the grandkids or other family members feel a little bit upset about that. But at the end of the day, as I say, you should respect the wishes of whoever's written that will. If it's been done, you know, without the influence of a third party or someone pushing them to do something that perhaps you disagree with, and it all depends on your own circumstances and the circumstances of the person that's written the will.
It's their money, isn't it, Simon? What do you think? Would you ever?
Well, as Lee said, I'd like to think that I wouldn't. And as you said, the same thing. But I think that there's a couple of things that are causing this issue. There is the rise in property values, which means that certainly in certain parts of the country, people are dying worth a lot more money than they once were. And because of that rise in property values, their descendants, their children, their grandchildren, essentially become slightly dependent on some form of inheritance in order to be able to own their own property if they want to live in that same area where they grew up. Then you've also got the increasingly complicated family situation, the greater prevalence of divorce, which then brings along a new partner, but also the new partner's children. Then if the new partner's children are then divorced and so on and so on. It's a complicated web. But I think that one of the problems causing this is people not getting their wills right, not quite thinking through the implications or not realizing the implications of certain things in their will. So understandably, you get these scenarios where, say, for example, you have a family. Let's say that the man dies first, right? Wife inherits. She then remarries. She then ends up leaving everything to her new partner. Now, it might be that she does that in order to avoid inheritance tax, because inheritance tax is a big issue. And if you leave everything to your partner, it is inheritance tax free. Problem is that if her new partner also has children, her new partner might be planning on leaving that money to his children and the children from the previous marriage. Now, the children from the previous marriage, who are probably grown up, might be in their 30s or 40s, might feel slightly aggrieved if essentially the family home, you know, they grew up in, that was their parents' home until their father died at the age of 55 or 60, for example, is now going to end up distributed amongst somebody else's family who, in all reality, doesn't have that much to do with it. And then you get the complicated thing where, oh, but that person didn't pay any money into the property in the first place. And you can see how all of a sudden this just becomes an unholy mess. And it's, I mean, it's even worse when someone dies suddenly, you know, earlier on in life or something like that, where there is no, they're not thinking through those expectations.
Is in that scenario you're talking about, and it could be a situation of they're living together in a home. And so by selling this home to pay inheritance to your children, you would be turfing your partner out of their home. Is there something you can do to mitigate that in the future, that you can put a clause in that says when this property is sold, it will then go to my children or not?
Yes, there are certain things that you can do, and I'm not going to try and advise exactly what those things are because I'm not a solicitor or a professional will writer, and the risk of me getting it wrong and then someone going, oh yeah, well that bloke said that on that podcast, that's what I'm going to do. There are things that you can do, and that's where you need to speak to a good professional will writer or a solicitor who knows what they're doing when you're writing your will, and but also question them about the bits in it. So I know that when I wrote my will, which we've discussed on podcast past, one of the things that the solicitor was really good at was answering my questions about, well, why this and why that and what does this mean? One of the other issues that has cropped up in recent years is something called mirror wills, which is where essentially a couple go and get a will written, and they both get a will and it mirrors the other one's will. So if I die, this happens. If you die, same thing happens. And that can cause issues, again, with the complicated family, property, you know, new partners kind of element. If you do get remarried, you are meant to get a new will. What I will be interested to see, however, after this week's news, is what happens with Karl Lagerfeld's cat, which apparently could inherit £100 million. and I would be interested to see if the cat doesn't get the money, whether it will challenge the will.
Yeah, that's very, very
because apparently
good
the cat does have the kind of retinue that would mean that it could do. It has two personal assistants.
Wow.
And presumably those personal assistants are looking at the cat that might inherit £100 million.
And what happens after
and,
the cat
and
does
thinking,
as well.
Well, hopefully there's something in it that says we have to continue to be employed to look after the cat and we'll be sorted for life.
It's these things that people need to discuss, isn't it? Like, I mean, Simon was talking there about house prices. Is this reflected in the most popular regions where wills are being disputed?
Firstly, can I just say that I definitely would write my cat into the will.
Yeah?
Yeah, I love my cat. I think my cat deserves a little slice of any of my future wealth. Okay. You are totally correct.
I'm sure the cat would be really appreciative.
You're probably correct on that front, Georgie. I mean, London was in the list of places where the most amount of wills are contested. But also, we've got to remember just the sheer number of people that live in London, of course. Yeah. That means that, you know, naturally, it's probably going to mean that there's more people contesting wills. Southampton and Norwich also on the list. Wouldn't say house prices, property prices there are particularly high compared to, you know, other pockets of the southeast. So I definitely think that there is a bit of that. And as Simon says, you know, the value of people's estates is going up. So people want more of a slice of it. It's that classic thing, isn't it, about family and finances not really mixing. And it's always the most awkward thing between family members in my mind. But yeah, I think you're right to point out property prices really have soared in the last sort of 20 years. And it also means that if you haven't sort of updated your will, looked at your will for a long time, it's definitely one of those sort of like nudge stories to get you to do it, or at least consider it if you haven't done it.
Is it hard to contest a will? I'm wondering because I can't think of any circumstances in which challenging a will is not going to cause a bit of rumpus. I mean, there might be individual circumstances, but like you said, family and finances. So by questioning it is going to be, you know, emotionally quite difficult. But is it a difficult situation to do it, or can you just subtly get your solicitor to just, you know, don't like that bit?
It is difficult. And actually, this direct line research that we've looked at, which analysed figures from HM Courts and Tribunal Service, there was 8,000 caveats registered in 2017, which is basically to block probate. So it's not actually really that widely done, which suggests that perhaps a lot of people do have correctly written wills, and actually they are pretty robust and pretty good. There has been a slight rise in recent years, and again, that is probably down to things like property values going out. But the research broke down the most common reasons for contesting the will. Now, what I thought it was quite interesting about this is the number one reason is undue influence. So what we touched on earlier, which is where the deceased was forced to sign a will or unreasonable pressure was put upon them. However, which I thought was really interesting, I'd never really thought about this too much, because we read so much of that kind of thing in the media, those kind of sort of like big stories that blow up. Legal experts actually say that contesting wills on those grounds is the least likely to succeed. So it's the most likely reason, but it's the most, this is what legal experts are telling us, that on those grounds, the least likely to be successful. It's basically because the burden of proof is so high, and it's very hard to prove that undue influence. So, yeah, I mean, it's not easy to contest a will, and it takes a certain kind of... You've got to be quite upset by it, I think. It's a lot of legal wrangling to go through. And there has been a big rise in people writing their own wills as well, which I think, you know, in certain circumstances, might not be the right fit for some people. The number two is lack of knowledge and approval, which is actually the one that's most likely to be successful, according to legal experts that we've spoken to. And that basically means that the person making the will was not aware of the contents, or there was suspicious circumstances. So, yeah, it's an interesting field.
I was speaking to a friend of mine the other day whose parents gave her money to get on the property ladder. Mm. And they had a conversation with her afterwards and said, because we gave you this money and we didn't give it to your sisters, then you will get less in the will. She was absolutely fine by that. If you are going to do something like that, just tell
people. Exactly. And a lot of people aren't open and honest about their finances. We're so British about it. And everyone's kind of a little bit, you know, a bit worried to talk about it and upsetting the apple cart and not actually really thinking about what people need in the here and now and potentially doing that kind of messing around. Your friend knows now in that circumstance that it's completely fair and it makes complete sense.
The last thing you want to do when you're grieving the loss of a loved one is to then find out you've been cut out in some way.
Exactly, and battling your siblings. That's another, we do see quite a lot of those kind of stories where siblings are battling each other and there's been all sorts of family fallouts over it, and it's again it's that whole family finances
thing. The tension was probably there beforehand in a lot
of
these cases.
Exactly, yeah. And you know, you don't choose your family, and in a lot of circumstances siblings don't like each other and bicker with each other and feel like, you know, one's had special treatment over another and all that kind of thing. It's a shame when you see those kind of cases, though, and you know, your family and you're fighting over these wills, and that's a lot of that goes on as well.
All right, Lee, well, we're going to leave wills aside and we're going to talk about millennials. This is one of my least favourite subjects after house prices, as you know, Simon, because I just can't see how or why you would want to lump a whole pretty large age group. And besides, who knows what is a millennial? You hear all sorts of different figures. Here, according to Barclays, it's aged 20 to 37, which seems rather broad. But why you'd lump them all together? And I think it's to a certain degree they used to pit generations against each other or to bash millennials. And this time in this particular story, I think it sounds like a bit of bashing. But let me explain what it is. So Barclays found that the average 20 to 37 year old, as I said, spends over $3,000 each year on takeaways, eating out, daily treats, socialising and buying new clothes. So, of course, the moral of the story is don't fritter your cash away. Don't eat your avocado and toast and you can buy your house. So you don't need to wait for your parents to die. Am I being unfair, chaps?
Georgia, I think you're being unfair.
Okay, great.
I think you're being a bit unfair. Firstly, can I just say, whenever I hear or see the word millennial, I sing it in Robbie Williams' Millennium. So I, millennial,
nice.
All the time. And the second thing I would say is I agree with the whole pitting generations against each other. You know, it's kind of, I'm technically a millennial, but what people think of as a millennial, I don't think is actually technically a millennial. I think people think millennials are sort of like under 20s and stuff. It's all of these phrases aren't that great. Simon and I have never been too keen on pushing all of this sort of like millennial phrasing. It's not great, but I'm going to defend Barclays a little bit in this. Right.
So what is the research? From the fact we fritter away £3,000?
It was a survey, and it showed that a lot of millennials feel like they're not saving enough, right? Which, okay, there's a lot of pressure out there, isn't there, to save for a house, and you know, cost of living is getting more expensive, and you know, job market is very competitive, and there's a lot of factors going on. It's difficult to you know, make your way in this world at the moment in way the economic climate is. So what it's saying is they're not saving enough. Now, the takeaway for me for this bit of research that actually I thought was quite interesting is what they said. It didn't say that millennials should stop spending, stop eating, stop buying clothes, you know, go walk around naked and eat leftovers out of the bin. It's not really saying that. I thought the interesting bit was saying that for every fifth, if they swapped every fifth takeaway, shop-bought coffee, a night out with a free alternative, or having a night in, it'd save 660 quid over the course of the year. Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting. I think that's an interesting stat. We live in a time now where everyone feels like they need to go and buy a takeaway coffee. And we're all guilty of it, and especially people in that 20 to 35 age bracket. Cutting down a couple of coffees, you know, what's that going to really save for you to buy a house? But it's not about that. It's about getting into that habit and cutting back on, you know, things like Deliveroo and stuff. People are more likely to get things like takeaways and unnecessary spending in that kind of manner, more so than previous generations, in my opinion. And if you just tucked a little bit of that away over the year, it's that lump sum factor that you can then start to get more positive and building up your savings goals.
Agreed. But I will add a couple of things to that, Simon, to what Lee's just said there. Is one, I think it's a psychological thing. When you are facing such, you know, high house prices, huge deposits to get, you want to enjoy yourself a little bit. And you think, do you know what is this £2.50 takeaway coffee going to do? It makes me feel better at the moment. Simon, you're looking very quizzically at me. But also, what's new about this? We hear all the time, every time we talk about saving, it's like, you're still looking really quizzically at me, Simon. This is brilliant. It's always coffees that get bashed. But the other thing is, I'm so put off by you looking quizzically, I can't even remember what the final thing was. Oh, yes. Aren't young people supposed to be drinking less, smoking less? So I would love to know what in the 80s and 90s, for example, people were frittering away on, you know, takeaways and all that. So there you go. Those are my issues with it. Simon?
Okay, I don't know where to start.
Okay, was that the quizzical look? What was the quizzical look?
Don't bother saving money because, like, stuff's really expensive.
No, that's not what I'm saying. It's a psychological mindset, and this is where we talk about money and psychology and the two combining. When you do have a massive student loan, when you are trying to save for a house, etc., a cup of coffee, look, I'm not going to complain. If someone's highlight of their day is spending £2.50 on a cup of coffee, you crack on because life is tough enough.
I would agree with you up to a point. However, I would say that coffee gets picked on because not everyone, but a lot of people in this country spend so much bloody money on coffee, right? Firstly, half of them aren't even drinking coffee. They're drinking a bucket of milk with a tiny bit of coffee in the bottom. So it's not like they can claim some kind of, oh, I really like my coffee. It's like, no, you don't. You like
probably
warm milk.
Milk anyway. It's You'd like warm milk. Something as
yeah,
well.
Flavoured warm milk. Yeah. The point is that's fine. If you're having one coffee a day, yeah, fine. You know, who would begrudge someone a coffee a day? But if you are having one coffee a day and you're spending £2.50 on your coffee, you're probably actually spending £3, but let's call it £2.50. And you're doing that 5 days a week. You're spending £12.50 a week on your coffee, multiply that out. All of a sudden you get to a year and you're like, that's quite a lot of money. Maybe if I just had three coffees a week and tried not to spend the other £5 or something like that, I could save a bit of money. But it's not. It's the problem is the people having three coffees a day.
Who has three coffees a day?
Oh, you! I walk in. I tell you what. We'll do a social experiment. We will. You know those people who stand by the side of the road. But you are much more financially savvy than most of the population.
No, I'm a caffeine addicted journalist. So
that's true. But you're also slightly more. You're slightly exactly. You're slightly more likely to be thinking about, oh, hang on, should I be spending this money? I bet if you stand at the coffee shop, you'll watch the same people come in 2-3 times a day. So it's just like cut out. Like the Barclays research is saying, just cut out one of them or two of them. I tell you what, if you're a coffee person, go buy yourself an AeroPress. They're great. Basically, they make really good coffee. Yeah. The AeroPress, invented by the man who invented the Aerobee, amazingly, hence the name. You can keep it at your desk, some water, makes a nice coffee. Do that, save yourself some cash. Because a packet of coffee costs you £2.50 as well.
I'd agree with that. One of the tips I do as well is get yourself one of those, I don't know, Costa or Starbucks plastic reusable mugs. Then fill it with your Nespresso coffee. Walk around the block with it. Pretend that you've actually bought it. You can even go into Starbucks, you know, stand there for a little bit and walk
But it's habits. It's habits.
But it's like it's psychology, right?
Yeah, and Lee is right, okay? Lee is absolutely right. There is a greater prevalence of people ordering takeaways, getting Ubers and things like that nowadays because it's so easy. Because you can just literally pick up your phone and do it. And when you have a takeaway, you invariably end up spending £20 or £30 kind of thing. It's not a cheap meal. And it's fine if you're just having one takeaway a week. If you're going, right, it's a Friday night, I'm not going out, I'm going to have a takeaway. You're probably saving more money by not going out. But maybe just cut out a few of them. You know, but if you're having three takeaways a week or something like that, it does all add up.
Yeah,
and it does
it
all
does.
Filter through. And yes, people, I guess in theory, people are spending less money on nights out than mm-hmm. they were because they drink less and everything. But there's been a premiumization. And this is not something that I'm inventing. This is something that has been observed throughout society. There are companies that have done very well out the back of it. And the problem is that people are going out. They might be buying less drinks, but the drinks they are buying are more expensive by comparison. So if you look at the price of a pint of craft beer, for example, and then factor that back, allowing for inflation, etc., to the price of a pint of normal beer that someone would have bought when we were in our early 20s. And I would imagine that you'll find that even though they might be drinking less pints, they're probably spending proportionately the same amount of money.
Again, it's not their fault. They're being hammered by the rise in prices of
But your question was, surely people are spending less on these things when actually...
No, it wasn't surely. Do we have the research that shows in terms of frittering away? This is why I said I don't like the idea of sort of bashing millennials for frittering their money on coffee and avocado toast. Look, they're probably spending as much. It's just because things are more expensive now, like houses.
That is true, but they are making... But there is a choice being made by people to go buy things that are premium products. So, and you pay for quality. But for example, if you go out and you have your avocado on toast in the trendy cafe on the high street and everything like that, you will be spending proportionately a larger amount of money than you probably would have done 15 years ago,
going into the
greasy spoon and having a full English or something like that. There is a different thing going on here. Now, I'm not criticizing those people for spending that money. I'm not saying they shouldn't be spending that money. I'm not saying, you know, don't enjoy your life, don't spend your money. But if you do want to save some money, if you do want to try and deal with the fact that life is more expensive, real wages are going up at the moment, but they haven't gone up for years. House prices have rocketed. The relationship between house prices and wages is stretched to nearly an all-time high. Rents are really expensive. That means you have to hand over loads of money in deposits. You've got $50,000 debt hanging over you from your student loans because some idiot decided that was a good idea to run the education system that way. The only person who can make these changes and start trying to attack that is you, because you could sit there bemoaning your lot, but that ain't going to change anything. So if you want to sit there bemoaning your lot, that's fine. Or you could try and make some of these small changes to try and get yourself ahead, because at least you'll be doing something, and then hopefully things will change around and the world will get better for you anyway.
I'm like a dog with a bone with this one. I'm not letting it go. No, there are certainly some things like a pint of craft ale that are more expensive. But take Uber. There's sometimes I will sit there and calculate in my mind, is it more expensive for me to get public transport than it is to get an Uber? Generally, it tends to be perhaps, I don't know, a couple of quid more to get an Uber. But you're thinking, for the convenience value, for just a couple of quid, the price of a cup of coffee, you get Uber. So this premiumisation may seem, in the past, I would never have got a taxi, ever. You know, talking about new clothes, for example, you can go and get a dress for a fiver. I wouldn't recommend doing that, but lots of people do. So actually, there's a lot of things that you can buy for a lot cheaper. And I was thinking, you know, back in the day when I went out for a good evening out, I could spend quite a lot of money going out. Now I'm just old, I suppose, and I don't go out so much. But I don't think a lot of people do. You know, there's a choice now that people are staying at home and saving more money that way.
True that, but I suppose the thing is, with the Uber element, there are lots of journeys that people would have previously taken by public transport that they're now taking Ubers for. And obviously I live in London, so I don't know whether this is an observable phenomenon in Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds, etc. But I would imagine that it probably is. And the reason why I would imagine it is because at least in London, we benefit from good public transport, as in you can get the tube somewhere, or if you can't get the tube there, you can get a bus. And people are still going, oh, I can't be bothered to get the bus. I mean, literally, the buses turn up once every 5-10 minutes and they're going, oh, I can't be bothered to get the bus. If you live in Manchester or Birmingham, you're bloody lucky if a bus turns up every 5 or 10 minutes. And you certainly don't have, you know, the benefit of something of a system like the tube. So presumably,
like the metro.
Presumably people there are. Whereas 10 years ago, it would have been, right, how am I going to get there? I'm not paying for a taxi. and there is that barrier kind of thing going on. Whereas now it's like, oh, how am I going to get it? Oh, Uber.
Yeah.
I think there is that kind of thing going on. My friends of mine live in sort of Stoke Newington, Dalston. From where I live, it's really annoying. You have to get the bus there. It should be really close, but you have to get off the bus, walk under the railway line at Finsbury Park, and then get back on another bus the other way, because the buses don't go under the railway line because they run double-decker buses. Quite why Transport for London doesn't run single-decker buses, so that you can go from the north of Islington to the south of Islington. I don't know, but I tell you what it does mean is whenever I go there, Uber.
Yeah. For anyone who doesn't live in London, massive apologies. I spend more of my life out of London than in London and in some rural areas. So my little violin is playing very sweetly for you right now, Simon. No, I do, Jess, and I know exactly what you mean. I'm going to let this go because I do. I'm probably protesting too much because I know I fritter too much away. No, just putting another point of view across. I just don't like the terms millennial. I don't like the way it's pitted against this idea. Neither do we, Georgie. Right?
I think I know what a millennial was originally meant to be. Someone who came of age around the millennium.
Yeah.
Hence the term. So that would have made you around about 18.
That makes me a millennium.
Around about 18 / 21 at the millennium. So it usually gets dated back to someone who was born 1980 or later. Although originally when it was, the concept came up because of, in America, the whole 21 thing, you could be a millennial if you were born in 79 or like 78, because you then would have come of age, the 21 thing around the millennium. But you're right, it has been stretched out. And actually, people don't think of people in their mid to late 30s as millennials. Mm. They think of people in their early 20s as millennials, when actually they weren't included in that. Mm. They are apparently Generation Z, yep. I believe.
Oh, yep. Now I'm cheered because I count.
Yeah, hey! You're a millennial, Georgie.
Lee, apparently we've got something called Money Diaries coming up. What's this?
Yeah, so look, we're trying to help out younger people that perhaps are struggling to get ahead on their finances. And the thing is, if you start, especially if you can start in your early 20s doing things like saving into a pension, getting a stocks and shares ISA, taking an active interest in what you could be doing to building a wealthier future, it's great that the earlier you can start, all thanks to the magic of compounding, and it will make your later life so much easier. So we've actually got a couple of things coming along that are going to be sort of geared more towards our sort of under 35 kind of readership. One of which is a Money Diary series that have been quite popular. Documents the spending habits over the course of a month of someone who falls into that age bracket. We have a look at what they've been spending money on, what their financial goals are, what their financial fears are, and what we can do to kind of help nudge them along, look at their short-term goals, their long-term goals, and what we can kind of do to cut back on, where they could be putting money to sort of help getting them ahead and ahead of the game. We're also going to have a little bit of a series on one of our reporters is in his early 20s, and he's going to be looking at how he started to invest and what he's been looking at and how he's looking to get ahead of the curve. But so by the time you're in your 30s, when everyone all of a sudden starts to panic about their finances, have I saved enough into a pension? Why didn't I get involved in investing earlier? It's because I didn't really take an active interest in it. We want to get more people involved in that. And this is not a millennial bashing exercise. I am slap bang in the middle of millennial, the age group of a millennial. We just want to sort of give more advice to those people that perhaps don't have it.
Bashing at all. If you write article after article saying don't drink your coffee, that would be bashing. But this is helping people set up good practices and habits for life.
That Barker's research wasn't saying give up your coffees.
I'm saying
one in every five coffees could get you that 600 quid figure at the end of the year.
Messing around. It's compounding of all the stories that people hear.
I can't bear it. I can't bear that kind of, oh, look at that millennial, you know, you generation snowflake and all that kind of stuff.
Exactly.
You know, it's not constructive. It's not what we're trying to do. We're not trying to criticize people. A lot of people come out of school and they don't know what a mortgage is, they don't know what a credit card is, they don't know what a personal loan is. We're in a country in which cheap credit is so easy to get, and it's so easy to fall into those traps. And even we're seeing a big launch of these buy now pay later type companies that are setting up, so if you were shopping on ASOS or one of those kind of like fashion websites, you can get that goods at the goods, and then you can pay it back over that six installments. You know, we're a generation used to getting what we want and when we want it, and we want it fast and we want
it without saving
for it. And that's what we're trying to get at. It's not a criticism, it's just what we've been spoon-fed you know, and we're lucky enough to live in a country which we get to make these kind of decisions, in which we have aspirations, in which we, you know, have things like social media pressure now, looking at things like Instagram, and the next thing you want to buy. We're bombarded with these kind of adverts 24/7. So much pressure to get on the property ladder when it might not necessarily be the be-all and end-all. We're trying to get under the bonnet and trying to help millennials actually, with some sound advice, get ahead of the curve. And also these Generation Z that seem to be getting left behind because it's not as catchy as millennials. You know, we're looking at those people that are just reaching adulthood. You know, not everyone goes to university. Not everyone gets saddled by university debt. What do those people do when they're starting work at 18? What can they be doing to get ahead of the curve? I think that's the key message, is how you can set yourself up for 25, 30 years of age and go, do you know what? I've got 10, 20, 30 grand in my pension and I'm feeling pretty smug about it and I'm set up now. I've made things so much easier for myself. It's not always going to be the case. It's not, you know, the world isn't perfect, you know, and that's what we're trying to get at. And what I say about it, it's not millennial bashing, is sometimes you get these stories, especially something that has like a case study in it, and people just jump on and start monstering the person that's in the story. You know, someone that's actually opened up and been honest about their own finances. So this Money Diary series is going to be anonymous, just because I don't want any of that. I want to encourage people to get in touch with us, to have a look at this, to read these stories and go, do you know what? I'm in that boat too. And that was interesting.
So Money Diary is coming soon?
Yep.
This is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I. For a gift your little ones will appreciate even when they're not so little. Give them premium bonds at nsandi.com.
Now, we spoke about investing there. That was the Money Diaries. You can read a lot more of that coming up in This Is Money. But Lloyd's small army of shareholders, which includes you, Simon, in their ranks, got some good news this week. But you've been writing about this and say, if you had any sense, you'd have probably sold them by now. So let's be honest, it's been a bumpy ride. Why do you still have them? And what's caused these musings for you, Simon?
Well, why do I still have shares in Lloyd's? As I said in my column, one of the reasons I may still have shares in Lloyd's is because I have them tucked away somewhere. And when I say tucked away, I literally mean I'm not entirely certain where they are, because they are paper share certificates. One of the perils of paper share certificates is that you actually need to keep hold of them and know where they are in order to buy or sell your shares. And if you want to replace them, they cost quite a bit of money to do so.
Be that as it may,
that presents a barrier. So you can't just go, right, I'm going to sell these. If they were just in my investment account, I might have sold them by now. But why do I even have them in the first place? Well, because I had got some free shares from the Halifax when it demutualised, when it stopped being a building society and became a bank, in 1996, because I was just old enough to qualify. If you had some money in a savings account, I believe it was £200, then you got a certain number of free shares, because as a member of the building society, you were one of its owners and it was becoming a bank and you would no longer be a member in the building society sense. So they gave people shares, so you would still become a shareholder. And I held them all the way up through the banking boom of the early 2000s. They hit the heady heights of £11 a share. And then I held them all the way down as the banks came crashing back down to earth. Halifax, it became obvious, Halifax Bank of Scotland was a basket case. There was an arranged marriage with Lloyd's, a bailout, an arranged marriage with Lloyd's. I then became a Lloyd's Banking Group shareholder, which incorporated Lloyd's and Halifax. And the shares at one point looked like they might be going to zero because the bank might be going bust. They did a rights issue in 2009, which is when they asked their shareholders for more money, in order to keep the bank afloat, and offered the opportunity to buy discounted shares at a price of 37p. At that point, I thought, well, I don't think that these shares are going to get much cheaper than they are now. Things couldn't get much worse for this bank unless it goes bust. I might take a punt on this. Mm-hmm. So I invested another couple of hundred quid at 37p. Lloyd's being Lloyd's, the share price did manage to go below 37p, but it then went back up. And at one point, I doubled my money on those shares. Unfortunately, Lloyd's being Lloyd's, it then managed to get kiboshed again. The Brexit thing hasn't helped. It's seen as a direct play on the UK economy. And they're now rocking around the kind of 60-something P mark, having got to about 85p. The theory behind keeping hold of these shares was that at some point, Lloyd's is going to get itself sorted out and these shares are going to go up in value. I can easily see a scenario where they become worth a pound, for example. So it's worth me holding on to these because I think long term, Lloyd's is going to be doing better. Lloyd's has pretty much got its finances sorted by now. The amount of money it's having to pay out on PPI claims, which has been holding it back, is easing. Mm-hmm. The idiotic mis-selling of PPI, I would say, because Lloyds, I believe, was one of the first banks to stop selling PPI, but it did that in 2010. But the thing is, the shares are now worth more than the 37p I paid for those ones. Right. They're worth considerably less than they were before the financial crisis for those ones that I hold. I have been paid a load of money in dividends, so I'm being paid to wait. But as I said in my column, I would have been paid a hell of a lot more if I'd have waited elsewhere, because if you go back 10 years, if you just invested in the average UK equity income investment trust, you'd be up 260%. That would be your total return. And I've had nowhere near that return from Lloyds. I believe the shares are up a tiny bit, like 8%. And I've had about 22% worth of that in dividends as well. So it just goes to show that just because you think something is a good opportunity, there may be much better opportunities elsewhere. And if you invest your money in one company, the opportunity cost is that you cannot invest it into something else that might be much better.
So there you go. You may not have made money, but it's been valuable in other ways, Simon. And if you were to have found those certificates, which I hope you will generally soon, would you sell them?
Not now. No, because I think that Lloyds has got its finances sorted out. I think that as long as we don't have a disastrous, chaotic no-deal Brexit that brings the country to its knees, which actually I don't actually think a no-deal Brexit would do anyway, mm-hmm. that once that's not hanging over it, it'll be fine and it'll be on its way back up to a pound. But don't take my word for it, because I'm the man who's been holding on to these shares for ages. And realistically, over the long term, they ain't gone anywhere.
Yes, indeed, Simon, but you are a sensible chap, so I'm confident. I can't believe you mentioned the B word, though.
It's taken ages today. That's the longest, I think, a podcast has gone in recent times with Brexit being mentioned that far down the line. Brexit.
Not again.
Is that because millennials aren't to blame for Brexit?
Oh, my word. Stop it. Right. At the end of the podcast, we always invite you to send in your queries, your issues, or anything you want to mention to the team. And we can't promise, obviously, that they answer them all or investigate all of them, but they do give it a good bash. And one particular question came in is from someone planning to move to Australia in the summer with their family. That's nice, isn't it? They want to know what will happen to their £40,000 that they hold in a cash ISA and £75,000 in a stocks and shares ISA. Will I have to close the account? This person says, this is not me, and withdraw the money when I move. I'm concerned that if I keep them, I will be taxed. Lee, what's the answer?
Well, actually, Georgie, we try and give as many of these questions a bash as we possibly can. And it's an interesting question, this, because, you know, a lot of people move abroad. Australia is probably the most popular choice. And if you have built up a nice little ISA pot, there is that kind of consideration of what can you do with it. Now, you do have a couple of options. If you transfer it abroad, you're obviously going to then lose all of that tax break. You're going to be stung on exchange currency fees, mm-hmm. And it's a little bit complicated. What I imagine a lot of people do in the circumstance is probably leave the money in there and don't tell their provider, but it's not a wise decision. It depends on your circumstances, but if you are, say, moving to Australia but keeping your property in the UK, you'll probably be fine because of the correspondence address, etc. But our advice here is that if you do move abroad, you should tell your ISA provider as soon as possible, because some do require you close the accounts with them. You can't hold them overseas. And we've seen quite a bit of this, actually, in the last few years. There's a lot of banks that are changing, move the goalposts for expats, making it far more difficult to hold a UK-based account when you're not actually living in the UK. Mm-hmm. There's that element to think about.
If you have to close it, then what?
Well, this is it. If you close it, you're going to have to take it with you. And I think a lot of expats, they kind of move away. So let's say you move to Australia, and always have in the back of their mind that they might come back because you might have family. Possibly. Or, you know, you want to rely on the NHS. And if you move to Australia, your pension might be frozen and all that sort of thing. So it's worth considering. That's a nice little pot, ISA pot, tax-free, has been built there. So it's a lot of things to consider. I would say that if you are going to move the money abroad with you, especially on a large sum like that, you must do your homework as to who you're using to transfer the money. I wouldn't rely on your bank. I wouldn't do it through your bank. You're going to get stung with quite high fees on a sum that large.
Who would you use?
Well, there's a number of sort of startup, well, I say startup, but you know, fairly established companies out there. So I'm thinking something like TransferWise, for example, is a good option. There are other similar ones out there. Just make sure you do your research at an FX company, but make sure it's a reputable one, because some of those companies can go bust pretty quickly. So you want, especially that kind of sum of money, you don't want to be sort of worrying about it. So just make sure if you use an FX firm, it's reputable. If you use one of the startup ones, it's one that's got a good reputation, and you can find out from your bank probably how much they're going to charge you for moving it into Aussie dollars, for example, pounds to Aussie dollars. It can be quite substantial, so you want to make sure. But my advice would be, if you're keeping your property in the UK, I would probably, you know, I wouldn't worry about it too much. I'd leave it there, unless you really need to take it with you and you need it to fund the property purchase, perhaps when you're in Australia.
Just one handy tip: if you are needing to move large sums of money overseas, do use a currency transfer service, and we actually have a service where you can compare them. It's run by our partner FX Compared, and there's some really good advice from them as well on terms of what you need to know about the companies you're dealing with. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/transfer.
Lovely little plug there, Simon. Well, Lee talked about giving it a bash. We've all been there in a car park or whatever. Either you get a minor bump, or perhaps you've pranged someone else. You exchange details, you report it when you get back, and away you go, right? The end of, or not. Now, you have a case of poor Kevin, whose bump turned into a bombardment from claims management firms. Over 100 since last October when it happened, and they show no sign, I believe, of letting up. Simon, take up the story, would you?
Yes. I think this is something that many people will recognise as an annoyance of modern everyday life, because I don't think there'll be many of us who haven't had the phone call of, you've been in an accident that wasn't your fault. And quite often it's a recorded message. You start off listening to the phone call, and then you realise that actually this is just a recorded message, and so you hang up. And you often wonder, how did these people get my details? And I mean, I get them on my work mobile phone, and hardly anybody's got that phone number. But anyway, this poor chap actually did have a prang, was bombarded with more than 100 calls, 30 calls from the Accident Advice Centre in 1 month up to January the 4th, 28 calls from First Response, 5 calls from Accident Management Group, 3 calls from Total Motor Assist, multiple calls from the Vehicle Assessment Centre, 3 calls from Accident Claims Management, 34 calls from 14 other numbers. Enterprise Rent-A-Car kept phoning him and offering a car, even though he didn't want one. Both of his insurers, so his car insurer and the underwriter, both say they didn't pass on the details. His insurance was bought from Bank of Scotland, not Royal Bank of Scotland, from Bank of Scotland. Cooperative Financial Services was the underwriter. Budget Insurance Services Limited, owned by the BGL Group, provides insurance customer service on behalf of Bank of Scotland, handling calls and claims. Vehicle Repairs and Replacement fall to Incident Management Solutions, which Kevin says is effectively a call centre. And then there was the enterprise thing. What this is a case of leaky data. Who knows where Kevin's details...
At which point?
Who knows? Who knows? Nobody's been able to pinpoint it. And all of those companies have said, nope, we don't sell people's data. Nope, we don't pass it on. Somewhere it's managed to get out of the system, because Kevin's been plagued by phone calls from people who know what happened. Not just chancing their arm, where a lot of these recorded messages are, if you send out enough recorded messages to people, you will get people who've been in an accident that wasn't their fault. But somewhere down the line, it's leaking out. And there have been stories of call centre staff being paid to hand over information for people and things like that. Your personal data is worth money, because if one of these companies gets a hit, manages to make a claim, you manage to get the money, they then take a cut. It is a worthwhile business for them, as evidenced by the fact that there are so many of them. The problem that Kevin had was when he tried to contact a lot of these companies to try and get them to stop phoning him, it turned out that there was no way of actually getting in contact with them. And it's a very, very tangled web. And one that I would imagine, if any of our politicians could pull their heads out of their backsides for 5 minutes, if they said that they were going to crack down on it and do something about, they might manage to win a lot of popular support.
It's appalling. Is there a regulator that can sort this out, Lee? This is surely not allowed. I mean,
I think it's absolutely shocking. The data in here from the Information Commissioner's Office, which regulates data privacy, said that it received more than 100,000 calls about nuisance calls just between January and September last year, and the majority are regarding personal injury claims. I think that's absolutely shocking statistic, and something that needs to be clamped down on and done. I mean, this poor gentleman here, I mean, 100 phone calls in a month. And what's also also happening a little bit that I've noticed. I get some of these calls, and I'm noticing that they're being replaced by like robots. So robotic voices that actually sound like humans, and it's really, really like the technology's improved way more. And I think that more needs to be done about personal data when it comes to motorists. Anyway, we've had in podcasts past where we've talked about motorist details being handed over when they've been in a private car park, and the whole GDPR murky rules around that. You know, it is leaky data. We don't know who sold this on and how it's been done. But these companies, we had a solicitor. I thought this was a great little quote here: personal data is more valuable than gold.
They call it the new oil, don't they?
Exactly, yeah. And the lengths that some of these call centres and companies go to are absolutely extraordinary to, you know, basically get your details.
What was the point of GDPR? I thought it was to hand back ownership of our data to us. Look, I'm used to the idea of getting nuisance phone calls about you being an accident.
But why should it be part and parcel of life? It shouldn't.
But with this story particularly, and it shouldn't, but I know I don't have a car, so clearly I've not been in an accident. But it's this element of who in this chain and how complicated, what you think is simple prang, you sort it out with the other person, you put your call in, that then goes through this whole, as Simon pointed out, load of different people to which, you know, the chain could be broken and your data leaked. That is the worry. And this man, you know, Kevin, can't find out where that's gone. Then what is the point in these laws being brought in?
Exactly. I think
I've got angry today.
No, I'm totally with you, George. I think it's absolutely disgraceful. I think, you know, at the end of the day, whichever company has gone about doing this needs to put their hands up and say, we've made mistakes. And, you know, here's how we're going to change. But, you know, of course, we get the whole, it wasn't us. He can't pinpoint who it is. We couldn't find out who it is. I think that in a world, as you say, that our privacy and our data is meant to be more secure than ever before, how is it that this industry, these practices are continuing? I honestly would love to see some changes in this. And as Simon said, this is the sort of thing that a government should definitely be focusing on after Brexit.
Well, you say the government, but I also wonder if the first point of call and the only point of call for Kevin was his insurance company, the buck stops there.
I agree with you.
If there's any leaking of data, then it goes on to, but then people say they'll raise insurance premiums, etc., etc. Do join in the debate, because we've run out of time. You can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you do have any comments on this or any other story or anything you'd like us to investigate, Simon,
then you can email us if you want us to investigate something, editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us if you want to talk to us and join in the discussion @thisismoney. And you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast, where you can argue amongst yourselves in the comments and call us idiots because we either said you should be allowed to drink coffee or you shouldn't.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us on iTunes? It helps people find us.
And one final word, because these two have been far too self-deprecating to do it themselves. We have a new podcast at This Is Money, another one for you. It's called This Is Moneyball. It is about money and sport and the business of sport, and it features two people sat in this room with me, Georgie Frost and Lee Boyce, who are very knowledgeable about it and also hugely entertaining. I listened to the first episode this week and I thought it was brilliant. Look it up at your podcast provider or come and find it at This Is Money.
You forgot every Monday. But good job, Simon. Good job. Money's in the post.
This Is Money, brought to you in partnership with NS&I Premium Bonds. Now you can start saving from just £25. Millions of tax-free prizes every month.